Connor Canning.
What is up?
How are you, my friend?
I'm very good, Matt Penna. How are you?
I like how we're introducing it like we haven't just spent the past like 2 or 3 hours together.
I know,
just
right?
Like
I just wandered in.
He just wandered in, and we just
casual conversation.
Just casual conversation. Definitely not hitting the grind.
Exactly.
Mics.
We were miking.
We're miking. You crushed. You did so well, and then
you too. It was fun. It was a good room.
He knows I'm fishing.
It was a good room.
You know, I always judge myself based on how I do with the mic. So it's,
of course,
it's,
how can you not?
How can you not?
Where we get all of our self-worth from. It's
Connor,
horrible.
It's literally the only way. Connor Canning, my friend, it's a pleasure to have you on, man.
Thank you so much. This is amazing. Dude, thank you so much. I don't really make a lot of podcast appearances.
I know.
So
it's an exclusive.
I know. This is big for me.
Connor, we start with compliments.
Mm-hmm.
Have you listened to an episode or no?
Yes, of course. Yeah, yeah.
He's the best. That's always, I always think it's fun to like... I've never asked a guest that, but I thought it'd be fun to accost you.
Yeah,
like,
just to make sure.
Do you listen? Do you,
you know,
actually?
Are you a fan?
Are you a fan?
Are you fake?
Does he support his friends?
Or are you fake?
Or are you fake? Mm-hmm. Real or fake? Love it. No, we start with compliments, and I thought about the compliment I wanted to give you, Connor, and it's that you're so smart. I love and. Oh, why are you making that face?
Oh no! I was all right.
I was like, he doesn't like the compliment.
No.
No, you're so smart, and it comes out in your work and everything of like that. And I love talking to you about history. You're a history guy, and I'm going to say this publicly because I have been hounding you to turn this series that you've been working on Instagram, which go follow Connor Canning, does these history. We'll call
B-sides, it B-sides kind of.
Yes, history, yeah. B-sides, but they have your voice and they're funny. And you had one about Irish people that went kind of viral.
Yeah, the San Patricios.
The San Patricios. Go look up the video. It's amazing. But Connor, you're so smart. And I always enjoy talking to you about just anything from comedy to books and what you're working on, all that good stuff, man.
Thank
you're
you, just, Matt. Matt, if we're doing compliments, I just love your energy, man.
That's
even from
the
from the first time we met when you were hosting the Buddha mic in.
Is that where we met?
It was the first time I met you. Yeah. I don't know. We didn't like. I don't know if we like officially.
Right.
I remember you very distinctly because that was also the mic I met Gabe Corser, who helped me co-produce my show.
Oh yes, and I love Gabe.
Yeah, it was Parkside Lounge, which they don't do mics at anymore.
They don't. Oh, they don't do them there anymore.
No, they stopped doing those. Yeah.
Oh, Parkside. Yes. Oh my God, I remember that. Yeah.
In that
yeah.
back room. Yeah.
Oh my God.
You just love your energy, man. You're
I appreciate
a super funny
that
guy.
Too.
You always bring good, positive vibes.
And that is why we do compliments up top, so that I can get my fix from this podcast. And that's
hey,
the
man, it's real.
You
inspire me
so
to be more.
Oh, stop.
Positive
that's,
and nice and
I,
open. And
you know, I appreciate that because it's. Man, sometimes you have these weeks and they're tough. We
that's
talked
what I,
about.
That's why I admire it, man, because it's tough to always to keep your head up, you know. But it's a sign of strength.
It's so funny because and he listens, which I think is funny. But Brian Elberg said something to me on this podcast I think about all the time, which is he goes, do you know? I like how we're talking about compliments and then like we're immediately talking about me. But no,
well,
he goes.
There's so many.
He goes. That's a very sweet. But he goes. He goes, you know, like your rep is like you're one of the nicest guys in comedy. And
yeah.
I was like, oh, that was really nice. And he goes, how does that make you feel that people aren't saying you're funny first? And I go, well, it wasn't bothering me until now.
That's
but
amazing.
Yeah, it was so funny. I love Brian.
But he's very funny. Very
yeah,
funny. Also, follow Brian Elberg.
Follow
a very
Brian
funny
Elberg,
New
very
York
funny comic.
Comedian.
Yes, and he's posting so many funny clips now. You guys can go check him out. And we're just here to plug other people. We're not
yeah,
here to
we're
chat.
Just,
but
no, yeah, there's no, plenty to go around.
No, it's so fun, Connor, because we talked about, and it's so funny because I had to direct the conversation a little bit because there's so much I wanted to get to on the episode when we were just like taking the bus back to Hoboken together.
Mm-hmm.
But like your love for reading is something like that I love because I used to love reading books
mm-hmm,
all
mm-hmm.
the time.
Yeah.
I was like, it was a thing. I used to go with my grandma to like the bookstore. It'd be a thing. And she would encourage us, you know, she would buy us each a book.
Yeah.
Couldn't leave this room until we pick one out. And then we would read.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, it's such a shame to say, but like, it's so, I don't know. I've lost time to read.
I mean, well, the phones and the screens all just suck our attention span away.
Yeah.
It's hard for everybody.
Is it hard for you?
Oh,
it seems
yeah,
like very,
yeah.
It seems seamless for you.
No,
too.
It is hard to, like, I have to, like, throw my phone across the room
really?
To make sure I'm
yeah.
not checking it in between. Oh, yeah. Sometimes I'll just catch myself. I'll be reading, and I'll just pick up my phone for no reason.
Like, yeah, let's
why am
yeah.
I? Why am I doing that? It's just a habit.
Totally.
Instinct. And so, yeah, the screen, I feel like screens and everything have just completely sucked all of our attention spans
well,
away.
And then, like, do you find, like, you'll do a stretch, maybe, like, you'll read for 20 minutes and then check your phone? And
I'll have to sometimes.
Yeah.
I'll be, like, my brain will be so fried where it'd be like, if I don't have, like, a schedule like that.
Isn't that a shame?
I
it's
know.
Just, like, it's awful, man.
It's,
like,
it's not good for us.
No, it's not. And we're not saying anything that's, like, you know, revolutionary or anything. But, like, I think about it all the time, man. Like, I'll go to see some shows that are like over an hour, and I'll get antsy like towards like an hour and 30, and I'm like, come on.
I don't know what it means, because there's even kids who have grown, because I remember a time before most people even had cell phones.
Do you remember your first cell phone?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I got my first one when I was 14, a flip phone.
14?
For high school, yeah.
Was it Virgin Mobile?
No, it was a Verizon. It was like the classic, like kind of dark purple one I feel like everybody had.
Was it like a Razor?
No, I wasn't that cool. My brother had a silver Razor. He was older than me.
Silver.
He had the silver Razor. Yeah, God. Very jealous. But it was when you had the T9 texting, right? It would be like, because you had to press the
button. Yeah. That's cool.
There's kids who have grown up who kind of remember before smartphones, and now they're like almost young adults who don't even really remember before, like they just always had iPads in front of them. Like,
yeah,
I don't really know. Like, it's very boomery take, but that doesn't seem like it's not good.
I know, and it's like, I don't know, man, but it's like the thing I come back to with that when I think about it is like, aren't we all just like iPad kids too?
No, that's
like
what I'm just completely fried everybody. Yeah, my parents who grew up, I mean, they lived like 40 years before they even knew what a cell phone was, and their brains are fried by it. So it happened to everybody. I don't know.
Yeah, so maybe it's just like the new normal that we're going to have to adapt to.
Oh, it definitely is. Yeah, it is the brave new world out there.
But someone, and I heard this on a podcast too, that was like comforting, which is like, you know, it might be something like, you know how like in Europe, like, you know, they'll let kids drink when they're 12, they don't binge when they're older. Where it's like they grow up with it, so they know how to use it and like incorporate it.
I think hopefully we'll develop like new habits around it, because we all were kind of just thrown into it.
I think that's I agree with that. Where it's like, I think that's where we're going to go, where we're actually going to see like, oh, this younger generation knows how to like separate and do the things.
Hopefully,
you would hope, but also I'm sure people get sucked into.
I know it's. I mean, just to live your whole life online seems terrible, but it does seem like we'll have to find like new normals for it. It's just too much.
Dude, we can't solve it here.
No, we can't.
We cannot.
But I do love to read. My parents always read growing up a lot. I read a lot. And it's just like a good way to kind of keep your mind sharp, right?
Well, that's the thing. And it's like, and that's why, because I used to really pride myself on intelligence when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
And I attribute a lot of that to the fact that I was a big reader. And like, I think what's
happening... definitely is, I mean, it's a sign of intelligence, I think.
You know, I completely agree. And I think it's insane that we're like talking about it. Like, they're saying that on like a podcast in the 2025, in the year 2025. But I just, I miss it. And like, when I really think about it, it's just very difficult, I think, to find the time during the day, because it always feels like we have so much to do that taking a half hour to just read maybe 10 pages or something.
Yeah.
Which a page in 3 minutes is very ambitious for me, but that's the other thing too. And it's another one of those. It teaches you, I think, in a way, like discipline to get through and to
patience,
just keep,
like,
patience.
Delaying gratification.
Yes.
Things like that.
Edging kids. You're edging with books.
You got to edge with books. Books help you. Books help you edge. That's how we'll get kids to read more books.
That's how we get them back into reading.
We got to.
So you can look. It's not on camera, but you can see those three books, baby. That is my trophy case.
Books
I read this
year. Oh, yeah. You told me Cat's Cradle.
Cat's Cradle, Slaughterhouse 5, and then The Soul of Money I read this year. Three books.
Hell, man.
Build the statue now.
That is three more than a lot of people.
Any
book, reading any, even if it's like, I don't know. I think people should read any book. Even if it's a book about like why Connor Canning sucks, I'm just glad you read it. I'm glad you read a book, man. I think that's cool. I don't love the subject matter, but I think it's good you read.
I don't agree, but you're
like, you probably could have found another one, I feel like. But you read one, that's great. I think like that's a net positive. Anybody who reads a book is a net positive for society.
I love that. I love that you're all it's my Connor Canning sucks.
I don't know why.
You don't suck.
It just feels a little personal.
It feels a little personal.
But you read a book, so
but
that's great.
But you did.
And I think, especially if you're like writing, like if you're a comic, like you're a writer,
it's so important.
You have to read. Like,
well, you need, and you need to fill your mind with the subject matter, or just the stuff to pull from is what you need.
You need,
man.
Like, that's so much inspiration. Like, so many like great movies and TV shows, and even like they get so many ideas from literature. Like,
and you don't even think about, I think, a lot of the times the way that reading a book will change the way you think during the day.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'll catch myself sometimes, you know, where it's like, oh, I wouldn't have thought about this idea if I wasn't currently reading this book.
Yeah.
You know?
But it definitely, it helps you just like think different ways and experience new ideas. And it's just like a healthier way of engaging with
it. It is. And it's just so sad, I think, that we even have to talk about all this.
I know.
Because what is your favorite book?
My favorite.
Give me right now, because I know all time. That's a hard question. Or you can give me top three.
I mean, one of my favorite books that I've read, like let's say that I've read like in the last couple of years.
Whatever you want.
I mean, I do love the Game of Thrones books. I've mentioned that. I love the third one, A Storm of Swords. I will reread parts.
That's the third one.
Yeah, that's where like the Red Wedding happened. Sure, it's where the like Joffrey's wedding happened. It's where the Red Viper and the Mountain duel. It's like the climax of a bunch of storylines. Sure. And it's just like page after page of just like epic action and cool stuff happening and crazy things. If a better pick than a Game of Thrones.
Well,
pick,
before we leave Game of Thrones, how did you feel about the show adaptation from the books?
I thought the first four seasons were incredible television.
Really?
I thought the first four seasons were... I mean, they changed stuff, some for good, some for bad. I thought the first four seasons were absolutely incredible television. I thought 5 through 7 were, like, fine. It was good. It was still... It was fun. There were some great episodes. It wasn't quite, like, peak TV.
When did they leave the series, or the books? Was it 6?
So, the books go... There's, like, the last... The 4th and the 5th happen, like, simultaneously.
The
5th are one big book split up. The 5th season is most of those books. I think some storylines end and some continue on into the 6th season, but it's mostly like 5 and 6. And then 7 and 8 is like totally off of.
Right, that's the...
Which is where it's the worst.
Yeah.
But it wasn't even just how bad the writing was. It was like they clearly stopped caring. Like you could tell, you know, with like the Diet Coke can, I think, or the Starbucks cup that was in an episode.
Yeah.
And just like some of the dialogue where you're like, if you watch even the first season, you're like, this dialogue was incredible. And it was all new. It was like a brand new scene and it was so great.
Yeah.
And then it was all just like nonsense at the end.
Why do you think they stopped caring?
I mean, I think they were doing that for like 10 years. It is a long time. What's crazy is, though, they had a bunch of actors who were still game to keep doing it, which is what's a bummer.
Yeah.
The guy who did Jon Snow, the guy who did Tyrion.
I mean, the cast is incredible.
And they were really all like, no, we want, like, it wasn't like where they were looking to be movie stars. They were like, we want to keep doing this. We love it. And the showrunners just weren't about it, which is a bummer.
I don't know.
And they also, I mean, they did sign on to adapt a show, not create their own. That was kind of the implicit agreement, right? Like, hey, you'll finish the series and we'll adapt it. Not, we'll finish the series and we'll also adapt it. Like,
How do you feel about a fan that's still waiting for the next book to come out?
I don't think they're going to.
You don't think it was,
I mean, I've been waiting since like 2013.
That's like, crazy. Yeah. It's like 12 years.
At a certain point, you're just like, oh, it's not. And even if the 6th, I mean, especially since, you know, with the pandemic, that didn't happen then.
Yeah.
But if the 6th one does come out, there's no way he finishes the 7th one. And the story is pretty long. I don't even know if he can finish it in 2. It's a very... There's still so much that has to happen.
Well, I was going to say, because I feel like for that particular story, it was... The books were supposed to add so much more build up to what the ultimate
was. You could tell like the bones of the end was like something that was supposed to be like was from his outline, but like the way to get there was so short and didn't make it was so abrupt.
Were you disappointed as a fan of the books that like you had to watch it unfold in that way instead of
kind of? Yeah, I still want to know what his ending was. I think it's mostly the same stuff,
right? I would imagine
mostly the same outline, but like how we get there and the way it happens, I think,
right? Which is really is the whole
the Game of Thrones books were important to me, very important. I was a big fan of the history aspect of it. It's all
well, we talked about it too, because it's based on the War of the Roses,
like the Stark Lannister York Lancaster, where the two rival houses. It's pretty different, like in The War of the Roses, the Starks, the Yorks, and the Lancasters were, like, branches of the royal house, whereas, like, the Starks aren't, you know, on the Iron Throne or anything.
Right, right. But I guess, like, where do you think your love for history comes from?
I mean, history is just, like, I mean, I always like stories, so I like storytelling.
I'm the same way. I think storytelling,
I like stories,
yeah.
I like storytelling, I like being a part of storytelling, and so much... And so many of the great stories we get is like based off of history or ripped out of history or inspired by history. So it was just like enjoying stories and then being like, oh, this is, you know, this story is actually loosely based off of this guy, and then kind of reading about that, or like this is based off of that, or, you know, that's where they get so much inspiration from.
Is there another like historical adaptation in like a book or a movie that you really love?
I mean, one of the ones I always mention is we've seen Game of Thrones, we've seen Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, yeah.
The, you know, when they're attacking the Minas Tirith, the city in the end. Last season, in the last
second movie,
no, the last movie,
in the last movie,
and the Rohirrim, the cavalry comes like right as they're about to breach the city.
With by the way, spoilers.
Spoilers, yeah. The ride of the Rohirrim, or Rohirrim, however you pronounce that.
Is that with Gandalf the White coming? On
yeah,
the
he's like, look to the west on
yes,
the
look
third
to the,
day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That is based off of the Siege of Vienna, which happened in 1692.
Yeah.
So Vienna was under siege from the Ottomans, and they'd just broken through the walls when the relief army showed up, and the Polish king showed up with the winged hussars. They were these like cavalrymen who wore these like giant wings on their back that made them look huge and really loud. And they charged into the Ottomans as they were entering the city and kind of like, and that was the end of the Ottoman kind of a threat to Europe.
Gotcha.
But they kind of like saved the city and saved
Europe. And that was, what you said, like 1692?
I think. There was the Battle of Vienna and there's the Siege of Vienna. I got it mixed up. One was earlier, but that one was the 1692. Jan Sobieski.
Can you imagine mixing up the Battle of Vienna and the Siege of Vienna?
Jan Sobieski was the Polish king. I remember that.
No, it's so wonderful. And then you recently read another book, which was, I thought was so interesting. Again, like instead of reading it, I'm just going off your explanation, but it was about, I think it was about a Greek army of about 300 men.
Oh, that, great book. Yeah. Sorry, I don't mean to jump.
No,
jump,
please. That's
Yeah. So it's called, The Sacred Band by yes. James Rahm, great historian, big fan. It's yeah, the Sacred Band of Thebes. So Thebes was a city state and, who kind of like fought for democracy against the Spartans, who are more like into aristocracy and like, more kind of militant. But yeah, they had this group of 300 warriors who were all 150 male lovers. So wow. They were all couples.
And so it was okay. So
that was their elite like strike force.
It was 150 gay men.
150 gay couples. 300 gay guys.
300 gay guys.
And the idea was that you wouldn't want to be dishonored in front of your lover by being like a coward. So you would fight harder to prove that you were like.
That
was the idea.
Well, and it was, were the men monogamous or would they have sex with other men in the tribe?
That's a good question. They definitely had, they would have children a lot because that was like your duty. So there was like, it was, they probably didn't sleep with other men, but they would have slept with women, some of them.
Gotcha. Okay. Wait. Say that one more time.
They probably wouldn't have slept with other men, maybe. Unclear.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
They would have slept with women, though.
I thought you were saying, like, they didn't sleep with each other.
No, they slept with each other.
Right,
yeah.
But not in the...
In Greek military, like, being... Like, having an older lover who showed you the ropes was, like, kind of part of it.
Right, because I remember hearing all these things about... forgive me, I don't know if it was Aristotle, but somebody would have... I mean... I don't even know if it's the same time period. I don't know, people, okay? He's much smarter than I am.
No, I just have read too many books.
But it's, I know that there is like a, you know, like in ancient Greece, you know, these philosophers would have sex with their students.
Yeah, Socrates famously was, he banged Alcibiades. Alcibiades, who was a very colorful character from the Peloponnesian War. I know this because I've read his, there's this book, this ancient book, by this, he wasn't even a historian, he was a biographer.
Yeah.
Plutarch. He wrote this series called Parallel Lives, where there were biographies of famous Greeks and famous Romans. And he would match them up with, like, if they had similar characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
He was like a character study. It wasn't really historical, but it's really valuable as historians because it'll talk about really important times in their lives or really like important anecdotes and we can learn about.
And
the
this
figures.
Is Plutarch is from what time period?
He was from he was from after. He would have been in like the second century CE.
Okay, gotcha. But it's him looking back
on people. Yeah,
and right. So it's kind of like a middleman between us and.
Yeah,
and
he wasn't. He was using primary sources, but he was himself 100 years gotcha. Removed from some of this subject.
But that's super interesting. So he would develop these like characteristics of all these like famous.
Yeah, so he would match like a famous Greek and a famous Roman who he thought had similar characteristics.
Gotcha.
And then it would kind of compare and he would have a paragraph at the beginning kind of comparing and at the end kind of comparing and contrasting their lives
that's
about
very,
like,
yeah,
who was better, who did things well, why was this Roman this way, why was this Greek this way. He was kind of like fascinated by the difference. But I've read that, which is why I know a lot of these random are odd. I guess Alcibiades isn't that odd. But
well, I was gonna say, what made him like so colorful?
Well, he was like a demagogue, kind of. He was very handsome. He was very
Alcibiades.
Yeah, he was like a beautiful boy.
Gotcha.
He also switched sides multiple times. So he was an Athenian initially, switched sides, won battles, then switched sides to the Spartans because he was accused of heresy.
Okay.
And then he banged the Spartan king's wife and made a bunch of enemies. So then he switched back to the Athenians, won a bunch more battles. And then I think died in exile. But he was like and he would always use like trickery and he would like in seizures
sure.
And he was like, yeah.
These pretty boys are always.
He was just like
something.
A duplicitous pretty boy, like who was constantly like always sleeping around.
Sure,
and just,
sure.
He was just like a really fun reality TV kind of character. the fact that I remember this, but I remember from his in Plutarch's story, there was a story of him wrestling, because that was like what the men did. Like,
right,
they would
that
wrestle.
Was big. Yeah.
And during one bout, he bit his opponent. And uh-huh. His opponent was like, you bite like a woman. And he was like, no, like a lion.
It's
Like, man, ancient Greece was crazy, bro.
What a funny thing. What a funny comparison.
And the historian was like, I'm going to put that in there. Putting that in this. That's people, awesome.
There are people watching, like, did he just say, like, a lion?
Like a lion? All right, dude. Like, all right. Aura farming, as the kids say.
We're bringing it back to the present.
Why am I talking about Alcibiades?
No, it's so interesting. And again, as someone who is not well read and who I guess pretends to be or tries to
be, you seem pretty well read, bro.
I've read multiple
Kurt Vonnegut books. I don't.
But that doesn't make me.
I haven't even read. I've read one.
But look at
Kurt
me talking
book.
About it, right? No, it's more. I think I used to be more in your camp when I was younger, but I think as I've gotten older, you know, I think it's just. Unfortunately, I don't make the time for it like I used to.
It sounds like you're doing all right.
I am trying. I always my big thing is like I love listening to podcasts and stuff like that. So I try and take a lot. I would say that has probably replaced reading, although I don't necessarily sit down and like listen to podcasts. I'm always
it's a different kind of.
Yeah, it's a different
medium,
kind of.
But it's still like, you know, engaging with learning and new ideas.
Yeah, but the storytelling thing is super interesting, and that's what I relate to most just because, and I get it from like a historical perspective. You would appreciate this. I took a ancient Greek and Rome history and literature course in high school.
Ooh.
Which
we read some ancient literature and stuff?
Yeah, we like read ancient literature and then also would go through the history, so we
that's
would
really
do
cool.
A, like
what would you guys read?
You would love this class. I wish I could remember.
You must read like the Odyssey or the
Yes, we did. We read excerpts from the Odyssey. We did Antigone, we did
Antigone, great.
Yeah, so we did like different stuff like that. But they had an Olympics, a knowledge trivia Olympics at the end of every year, and they would hang posters in the classroom of the students that won.
That's
and
cool.
I remember they came in to like talk to us about the elective when I was a junior, I was a senior class, and I was like, oh, man, one day if I can just be up there, and I did it.
Fuck yeah.
I did dude. I won. No, it's like probably like the most tame fuck ever said on this podcast.
I can over I that? Yeah,
who yeah, cares? Yeah. Who cares? But I'll try and find the picture for you. Yeah,
you won the
I won the trivia thing. It was me and a team of two of my friends. I think it was or three people. It was me, Liam, Emily, and Lauren. I think we were all on the same team. And what they did is they would take you. It was you and your team. It was almost like Survivor style, where it was like your team versus like another four teams, however many people were in the class. And then in the final round, the team had to be split apart.
And then you had to go
pitted against each other.
That's awesome.
And they had it in the auditorium, so it was like us.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, it was honestly, they don't do the class anymore, which is really sad.
That's super cool.
But it was, I remember,
your teammates too?
I did.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so it was very, I remember I ran away with it too at the end.
Oh, really?
Where it was just
ran
like,
up the
boom,
score a little bit?
Boom,
oh,
boom,
yeah.
Boom. I got every, and that is where I peaked. And now I do this.
And hey, now this isn't a bad place to be. Hey, I'm here too.
No, it's not. I love it so much. And man, the storytelling, it's just that element is so interesting in history. And then, I mean, like, what I think about a lot, just with history in general and right now, is like, what time period is very similar to what we're going through now in American history. I mean, I don't know if you have the answer.
I mean, people compare it to, the '60s and '70s, the turmoil that happened then.
Like in the United States?
Yeah.
Really? Like in the sense of like, and I guess like where I'm leading with this, where it's like people compare it a lot of times to like the fall of the Roman Empire and that kind of thing.
Of course. Yeah, absolutely.
But you do see '60s and '70s elements?
I mean, the '60s and '70s, in one way, like we're almost worse. I mean, there was like, there were lots of bombings kind of throughout the country from like different like dissident groups. There was a lot, probably more political violence than there is now. There were more assassinations. Yeah. I mean, you had MLK getting shot, JFK getting shot, RFK getting shot, Malcolm X got shot, Medgar Evers got shot.
All right, four more.
No. You had Margaret Thatcher getting blown. I mean, she was in the 80s, I guess. It was just, I mean, it's so present now. You can see it on every TikTok scroll, on every Instagram scroll. I mean, it's so much more present now. I mean, the idea of like the fall of the Roman Empire, like a peaking empire, or like the end of the British Empire. It's definitely in that mold, it would seem like, where like America was, kind of a hegemonic power. It was kind of the sole power, and now it's going to be like a multipolar world where America's influence is definitely less present, and what that means for the world is we'll probably find out, because it's kind of like currently happening.
Yeah,
because it was even starting with the Cold War, there was the Soviet Union as like kind of a bit of a counterweight, but now there from like the 90s on, it was kind of just America, and now it's kind of going to be a multipolar world with like different pockets of power and different spheres of influence.
Yeah.
And yeah, just a lot of turmoil. The thing that makes it so different from it makes it hard to compare is the technology, right?
Yeah, because we've never. Yeah, and
it's so easy to communicate. It's like, and it's not just that it's like a little easier. Like it's, you can communicate across the globe in an instant. You know,
right.
it's so different. It happens so quickly, and we were so unprepared for how quickly it all happened and communication changing and connect. Like,
right, and then you add in the element of AI and what that's going to do.
Exactly,
to economies
like it. That's what's so scary is how fast technology changed. That's what's kind of not really, there's no precedent for.
Or that's a really good point because, yes, it's the pace, right? Yeah. It's already.
It's happening. It wasn't like, you know, even when you had the printing press or the radio and television, those things were kind of gradually introduced. It was kind of like between 2008 and 2012, everybody kind of got a smartphone pretty much.
Yeah.
But in that time period, pretty much everybody got a computer in their pocket. And it just completely changed the way we interact and do everything. And COVID was kind of like the final seemed to be stamp on that.
Yeah, and you know, it's just so interesting because we have never, and it's because it's so anxiety inducing, we have never like truly deconstructed COVID and what it's done. Nobody talks about it.
Yeah, it's weird.
Nobody, I mean, everyone just pretends like it didn't happen.
That's what kind of blew my mind. I don't know if you remember when COVID happened. People were always talking about like the Spanish influenza.
No, there was never COVID. There was never, no, I'm just kidding.
People were
But
people were talking about the Spanish flu and, that happened,
yes.
The pandemic.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were like, yeah, there was like a, there were like lots of very similar like anti-mask movements. There were people, there were like quarantine. There was a lot of very similar things that was going on.
Sure.
But it was something that, but you never ever heard about the Spanish. No one ever talked about those quarantines. No one ever talked about, it was not something in popular culture. And you kind of understand why. On some level, you almost don't really want to go through it. It was just so, it was so weird.
Yeah. And it was, and we're going to, because I think it comes up in your low point about like the pandemic and stuff, but I just, in some ways, it feels like we're still in it, you know?
It does seem like it was a watershed. It was like, think there's before COVID and there's after COVID.
Yeah.
Is,
which
what, is how
very,
I think about it.
Yeah.
Like,
which, yeah.
The, like, before 2020 is just, it's kind of a different era. It's like the it's like the dead ball era in baseball. It's just, you know, it's just a different time.
He's appealing to the host knows. No, you're 100% right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's like, just, it's almost, you can't compare almost.
Yeah.
It's almost difficult, like, it changed so many things. It accelerated so many things that it's like difficult to be like, oh yeah, 2017 was the same period, like was the same era as 2012, 2022. It's like, there's no. It was,
well, yeah, no, you're, I mean, you're 100% right. And then that, but that's the scary thing is, right, it's the, it's all changing so fast.
Yeah.
And it's like, and we looked at COVID, like it can change your whole
things,
world.
The whole world
can
get turned upside down in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Like, and things happen so fast, new technology, new ways of communicating. And we clearly haven't come to grips with it.
And it's the, like, there's no incentive, right? And whatever, I mean, regulation you want to put around AI and new technology is just not working.
I don't know how, I mean, it's hard to put the toothpaste back in the tube, right? Like, it's all, it already is all out there. Like, it's hard to be like, okay, well now, I know you had unlimited social media, but now we're going to need to limit that to like 2 hours a day. Like, no one would go
for
that.
And the companies don't want
to
do that.
Or being like, you have to be 18 to be on Instagram.
Right.
That's not
going to
happen.
No, that'll never happen. Because also, companies won't stand for it. And then
It's already ingrained. It's already it's too enmeshed in the way we communicate everything.
Do you feel, and it's kind of depressing, do you feel as hopeless as like I do in that sense?
It definitely happens sometimes. I guess the hopelessness comes from like, I don't see how it gets better.
That's my thing.
I don't know what would happen that would make it better.
Right. I agree with you there where, you know, I just don't know.
It just seems like it'd be a constant kind of slide generally down, trending down.
Right, exactly.
With I don't know what would, it seems like any big massive conflict that you would expect to like bring everyone together would just divide everybody more.
That's the biggest thing, yeah. And especially, I haven't seen it yet, but what I've heard about, did you see Eddington?
No, I haven't.
No, but I heard the biggest concept is like, the concept of the movie is how, you know, your reality is kind of shaped for you via like social media and all these different things, which like makes sense, right? So it's like it can just stay divisive.
That's what, it seemed like COVID was something you thought like maybe the world can kind of come together and battle this kind of unseen virus and we can all kind of do it together, but it just divided everybody more.
Yeah.
Like people always say like there's like kind of a meme where it's like if aliens invaded, maybe then all of humanity would be able to like get together.
Right. Even
and
then,
it's like, I think even 30% of the country would be welcoming the aliens and being like,
true.
This is so, they're better than our government. We need to welcome the aliens. They clearly love us. It's what are you gonna trust someone from Washington over someone from Mars? Are you crazy?
That's so good.
It's like, I honestly don't even think that would get everybody on board.
Do you do that on stage? That's so funny. No. You should write that down, man. That's so funny. I always shout out Catherine Duffy when I say that because she makes fun of me all the time. But like, I can't resist when someone says something funny. I'm really? Like, do you do that on stage? She makes
it's
fun of me all the time.
It's stage funny, you think?
I think it's stage funny. That's a fully formed bit. The aliens come down. I think 30% of people would be on the side. That's a great idea. I'm already on board.
Yeah, it seems that way.
I would think so, right? Because, I mean, it makes sense.
It doesn't. We hate each other so much. Everybody is just so mad.
I was thinking about this, too, this week, and it's like, why are we so angry?
Everyone just hates each other so much.
Why? Like, do you think it...
I think everyone's bored a little bit. And they're mad. And they're not... Things didn't quite... Most people, you know, they're not... Things didn't work out exactly how everyone wanted.
Yeah.
So everyone's mad. And they got a chip on their shoulder. And they want someone to blame. And everyone just is so angry at each other. That's a little bit alarming.
Well, that's the thing. It's like... And I don't... Obviously, you know, we're not going to solve it here. But like... You think about why people are so angry. I mean, could it be, you know, I mean, just that I always come back to this, but like, is it the fact that we're all carrying dopamine zapping devices
probably.
In our pocket?
It's probably a big part
like,
of
is that why we're all fucking
like modern life is clearly unfulfilling for pretty much everybody.
Yeah. And it's, you know,
everything kind of feels a little meaningless.
Yeah.
You're not tethered to anything.
And is this like, is this the, I always go back to, and I think about this sometimes from Fight Club, where, I think it's from Fight Club, where it's like Brad Pitt is like, you know, our fathers and their fathers fought like a physical war. We're fighting like the spiritual war, where it's like, you know, is this something that's just all of humanity has dealt with the entire time? And now it's coming to like kind of a front.
Maybe. I mean, it just seemed like we're entering like a different era slightly of like, you know what I mean? Like where it's like, there is a decent amount of abundance. And everyone's just things, you know. I think there's the famous Louis C.K. bit where it's like everything is amazing and no one's happy. Like,
yeah,
you can fly to another continent. You can get food from all over the world. You can do all of these amazing things, and it's just there's something unfulfilling about it. It just seems like we've moved beyond what our brains can handle, or we haven't figured it out.
Right, and that's and it's funny because like we talked about. One of the books I read this year is like it's The Soul of Money, and like one of the ideas it talks about in it is this idea that like we're on the precipice of that next part of our transformation.
Yeah,
which like I don't know. Does it make sense that you know in 100 years we're gonna figure out at least that next part where. But I don't know.
That's one.
Does it have to get that bad to get that much better?
Can I get annoyingly philosophical?
Absolutely. You
can. Like one of the things, like a lot of existential philosophers, like in like the 20th century, what they were kind of like dealing with this almost a little bit ahead of time. So like they were dealing with like, so like the Enlightenment kind of like the Enlightenment, like kind of rationality, kind of killed a lot of like religious belief, right? It kind of made religious belief less and less common over from like 1700 kind of onward, right?
Sure.
Like the Enlightenment, rationality, and religion in most parts of the world was kind of like the underpinning of morality, and that's all gone for the most part.
Yeah,
you know. So what is the next? What fills that gap? When Nietzsche wrote that like God is dead, he wasn't really like celebrating necessarily. He was kind of just like stating a fact, and he was like, okay, well, what's going to replace God? That was what a lot of like 20th century philosophers were, like kind of figure out. Like, how do we make man feel fulfilled and a part of the universe without religion? And I don't know if anybody's really answered that question, honestly. It doesn't seem like there's been a coherent or acceptable answer for enough people. Like, what gives your life meaning? I don't know if enough people have an answer to that.
No, I agree. And it's almost toxic in a way because I feel like in our culture, we always look for it outside of ourselves, which read any story ever, that's never the answer, right? And it's, you know, are we getting farther away from that ideal? But what I would counter is now with AI coming into play, will that give us a contrast to say what is will we have to sit down and define what makes us human versus, you know what I mean?
The counterweight to it.
Yeah,
the counterweight,
you know, might help us out.
It's hard to feel like optimistic, you know, about
it. Well, that's the thing, but it's like, are we so deep in it that like we can't see the long-term effects of it too? The lack of God in connection with that is so interesting because I do think that's a big part of it, right? Are so many people that aren't religious today.
It was for centuries. It was even before, you know, pre-Christian, pre-Islamic, pre, you know, the monotheistic religions. Excuse me, so sorry. pre-monotheistic religions, it was still like the underpinnings of your life, like the worship of the gods and how the universe and your place within it, you know?
Right.
That was how humanity understood that. And like, and then all of a sudden, you know, the Enlightenment comes along and it's like, hey, that's all nonsense. And that's not how we get meaning from. And so where do we get it from? And nobody has really had a convincing enough answer that I think maybe is fulfilling.
Well, I think there's another book I read. Watch this. Viktor Frankl's The Man's Search for Meaning.
Yeah, of course.
Which Sean Conrad has my favorite joke about that.
Oh, really?
Oh, he said his dad lost his copy. And I'm sorry if I'm spoiling the joke, Sean. But he has a joke where he says, his dad lost his copy of Man's Search for Meaning. So it became Man's Search for Meaning. And it's so silly.
He's so funny.
But he's so funny. I love him. Go listen to his episode, too. It's great. Sorry for blowing up the joke, Sean. I hope that's okay. You can yell at me later if you hear this. But one of the things I talk about in that book is, right, it comes down to, and I wish I could remember the three off the top of my head, but I believe it's, he breaks it down into three pieces, which is, I forget the first piece, but it's you're putting meaning into the work that you do. Mm-hmm. The people you love, or it's your finding meaning in your suffering.
Yeah.
And so those are the three ways that like man can find meaning. And it's one of those, do you ever have these moments where it's like you really understand an idea and then it kind of fleets and fades away a little bit?
Yeah.
There was a point where I was reading that, and that third one, find really making meaning out of your suffering,
that's
really made a lot of sense.
So Catholic.
Yeah. Oh, dude.
So Catholic. Oh my God, is that Catholic?
what were you raised? Were you Protestant?
My parents were not. I mean, I say culturally Catholic.
Okay, that makes sense.
Which was like we had stopped going to church at that point.
Well, I was gonna say Irish Catholic, right?
Like, yeah. But it was more like I said, culturally Catholic, just kind of like being loud and having a big family.
I get you. That's so funny.
We didn't go to church.
It's so Catholic. my brother and my dad still go to church. I do not.
Yeah. Like I said, I respect the community aspect of it.
Sure. Yes. Absolutely.
I respect that. For me, it's just not. I was never. It never made much sense. Also, this is going to maybe sound a little bit odd, but I didn't really read the Bible until later when I was like a teenager. And what just struck me as very odd, and I don't know that no one else really ever mentions this, but I was like, okay, so this takes place in the Middle East, and I'm not from there. I don't know. None of my people have ever been from there. This kind of feels like a Jewish kind of Arab kind of a thing. I don't know what it has to do with guys who look like me. It was hard for me to understand why, as like an Irish Hungarian background, I should care about these weird stories. From the Middle East in the Bronze Age. We have our own. I don't know. I don't know what it has to do with me. It's not. None of the guys in the Bible look like me. None of them.
Yeah, it's. Well, my favorite
no
thing
one
is,
was named Connor in the Bible. I don't know, like, why. There was a part of me that was like, okay, this is cool, interesting stories, but, like, I have my own. If I just need, like, you know, parables or whatever to, like, remember to be a decent person, they have those in other places.
Yeah, and you know what's a shame is, like, I do think, like, you know, I'm not saying that it doesn't have value. I do think it does have value.
Oh, of course,
No, and that's not what we're saying.
I meant for me personally.
No, I know what you're saying.
I
completely understand, because again, like, you see all these paintings, it's like Jesus is white, and it's like Jesus was not white.
He was not. He was like a short little Semitic dude. Yeah. He looked nothing like me.
And my favorite thing to tell people who don't know is that Jesus was Jewish.
Yeah, I know.
And they get angry.
It was a really big part of his life, actually. It was actually like kind of fundamental to who he was.
Which I think is so funny, telling people who
it is crazy. That's the whole thing.
Yeah,
he was really Jewish.
He was.
Like.
He was so.
He wasn't
Jewish.
Like culturally Jewish. He was very much Jewish.
Mike Birbiglia has my favorite joke about it, which is in Thank God for Jokes, where he talks about how Jesus wouldn't win in the general election.
Oh no,
because he's
that's
a socialist.
So good.
He's a Jewish socialist. He's Bernie Sanders.
He really is.
Which that blew me away when
that's
I saw
so
that.
That's so funny.
It's so funny. But yeah, you just really had me hung on this idea that, like, you know, what replaces faith with, especially in this day and age, right? Where it's like, and let's face it, I think you can talk to a lot of people that are depressed and anxious, and it's because
they're not tethered to anything. I mean, I feel it too. You know, like, you have those moments where you're like, what, where am I just floating through space? Is there any meaning to anything? That is everything just random?
Right.
You know, those kind of anxiety spells, and I don't really always have an answer.
Yeah, and it's
just look at a picture of my dog. And
they bring you back. The pets will bring you back. They really do.
You gotta find it wherever you can, right?
That's the thing, man. You gotta.
I mean, Kierkegaard said it. You just kind of have to believe. He called it a leap of faith. He was like, "Yeah, it doesn't make any sense, but just believe. Because if the alternative is not believing, and that would drive me insane. Well, I kind of get what you're saying.
In God or just in...
Yeah, believing in like God. Yeah, he called it a leap of faith. He was like, yeah, there's no rational basis for it. You just have to believe.
Yeah.
That it's just a leap of faith.
Yeah. But in the sense of like a man in the sky type thing, or...
Yeah, I guess,
Or
like
I guess it applies to any sort of...
Yeah, anything like that. He's like, there's no rational belief in any like higher power, really. There's no reason to believe that. So it's just kind of a leap of faith.
I think it's kind of, you know, because there's that classic question, what happens when we die? And that kind of thing.
What do you think happens when we die?
You know, what I come back to, and this is recency bias and the way I'm explaining it, because I was listening to this on a podcast, but... You know, you have to come back to the idea that, like, when you were born, first off, I think it's, I read something beautiful in The Power of Now, which is that death is dreamless sleep.
Yeah.
Which I found very comforting.
Yeah.
Not all people do. I found that very, very comforting.
I think so.
Because you remember, you know, we kind of die every night, and it's when we go to sleep, and we, you know, we kind of, if you look at the way I've been kind of looking at my day.
Death is a cousin to sleep. Or sleep is a cousin to death. That's Shakespeare.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean,
Hamlet has tons of imagery about sleep and death.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, trying to think back to
to
like
dream
Hamlet,
to sleep no more.
Yes, oh, beautiful. We're going to get into all the Shakespearean
stuff
in a sec. I think about it, and man, you know, I kind of just look at it, you know, because like your day is kind of like a life. It's a mini life,
yeah,
right? And I kind of look at it.
You start fresh
that.
Every day.
You start fresh every day.
That's a great way to look at life.
I try. I don't always live that way, which is the main thing. When that's kind of where
hard.
I find myself in trouble. It is very difficult, but you know, I think when I think about death and what happens, I think it's. Ram Dass says this thing. I think, you know, death is like taking off a tight shoe, where it's kind of like this release. And
yeah,
I come back to, I'm going to be quoting Ram Dass. You can tell this is based off the Pete Holmes You Made a Weird podcast. But no, what I'm trying to say is that when I think about death, right, I think, how am I trying to articulate this? I am trying to say, I think it's a lot sexier than people think.
Okay.
I don't think the story of you, Connor Canning, or me, Matt Penna, goes anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think any of that goes here. Because remember, that is all us. That's all the story we attach to ourselves.
Yep.
That I'm a comedian, you're a comedian,
yeah.
Actor. Like, those are all the stories and attributes that we identify to ourselves. What we are at our core, I think, really is... it's not as sexy, and it's not as... You know, it's just this awareness.
Okay.
And I don't mean awareness in the sense consciously, even. I just mean...
You kind of go back to the universe a little bit?
Yeah,
like
I think it's whatever...
The energy or the part of the universe you are is kind of sent back to the universe.
Yeah, and I think it's just kind of like...
Dust
to
dust.
Yeah, and I think it's more just... But I don't even think of that, because one thought I've had recently is like, we get so scared when we talk about death.
Mm-hmm.
When we have these imagery, we think of cold and all these skeletons and scary look at Halloween.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
At the same time, my counter to that is, that's the ego's interpretation of death.
Yeah, okay.
That's not actually what it is.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's just ourselves, whatever light that is within us, returning to this, to wherever it came from, and then coming back out, and that might be where, you know, reincarnation comes from, where it's like all these different. So that's just kind of like how I think about it.
Yeah, that's comforting, I think.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, I always think too, it's like, and this is gonna sound weird, but I've been watching so much of The Pit lately, which
I don't have.
It's
HBO
such
right
a great
now.
Show.
I know,
but
my
brother is an emergency department doctor.
Oh, he is.
And he,
how many brothers do you?
I have two brothers.
Two
so
brothers
one's younger. He's a nurse. Also does amazing work. And then my older brother's a doctor. But these guys are around death all the time.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, I just think we in our day to day, like, don't think about it necessarily in that particular way or are confronted by it that much. But, you know, whenever I try and think about that too, it's like, you know, and it's, I mean, it's part of, you know, it's just, it's part of the journey, and it's part of what gives meaning to life, because without it, what's the alternative? That we live forever and nothing, I mean, then really nothing.
Yeah,
is,
exactly.
Is,
then nothing would matter. Yeah.
Nothing would really matter. You know what I mean?
Death gives life meaning. Yeah.
Well, that's a beautiful sentiment to transition to our low point. That might be the worst transition I've ever had.
I don't
Do you have any closing thoughts, though, before we get into what you're talking about?
I think I really like what you said about death, honestly.
Yeah.
I think it's a comforting way of looking at it.
I appreciate that, because I think, you know, sometimes... I mean, it is so scary, right? It is so scary to talk about.
And it's so different. It's
It is, right? And again, I'm talking about it from a place, obviously, that I'm not saying anything about the... I don't say any of this, and I think this is pretty clear, to diminish the grieving that people go through. Like,
no,
you know
no,
what I mean?
No, no.
It's not. But what I'm trying to say is that I really don't believe that, and maybe this is where that leap of faith comes from, right? I don't believe that that light goes away. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I really do believe it just it just kind of...
Well, energy doesn't... You can't destroy energy.
Well, that's another big truth. That's science. Yeah, that's scientific. Yeah, absolutely. Which, whatever, that's another rule I come back to, too. So, got to listen to the universe, man.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
I love it. Connor Canning.
Matt Pana.
We're going to talk about your low point. We're going to get into it. I love it. You wanted to talk about being an actor and majoring in theater.
Classical theater acting.
In classical theater acting. So can you tell us, take us back, take us to Connor the boy.
Connor the boy. So
was he Alcibiades? Was he a pretty boy? Just
I was a cute kid, I think. I think I was a cute kid, a little blonde hair, a little blondie.
Were you blonde?
I was very blonde, yeah. Wow. Like white blonde. So my sister did theater and acting, and I kind of like tagged along and liked being it.
Your sister's older?
She's older, yeah. Okay. My older sister did kind of theater, and I kind of tagged along. I just really enjoyed it. You know, I liked, you know, you got to carry, you had to have a sword sometimes. You got to be on stage and get attention.
Sure.
So I kind of did it. I stopped doing it in high school a little bit to kind of play more sports because I went to a very sports-heavy school.
Gotcha. Okay. Did you miss it while you were playing sports?
A little bit, yeah. So I did, my freshman year I was in a play, and then I kind of stopped. And then the senior year, they were doing Death of a Salesman.
Did you go back to do that?
Yeah.
Who did you play?
I was Biff.
That's cool.
It's like my dad's favorite play. It's one of my favorite plays.
Did that mean a lot to get you to see
it? Yeah, it was really cool. That's cool. They had like an old professor come back to play the dad. So we had like an actual old man playing Willie instead of just like a kid in makeup. So that was really cool.
That is really cool.
So he had done some acting before, so I got to be like act alongside him. Which
did he have a lot of experience that you got to...
Yeah, which was really cool.
Did he treat you well, like as a counter actor?
Yeah, so he had been a professor at the school.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He was a Spanish
teacher
who had done some theater acting. Gotcha. And had been a theater director, so he was really great.
Did you go to boarding school?
I wasn't a boarder, but I did go to prep school.
Okay, gotcha.
So my brother got a scholarship because he's like an astronaut. He's so smart. No, he's not an actual astronaut, like smart. Like
oh, gotcha.
He's a solar engineer. Yeah. He's crazy smart. He got a great scholarship to a prep school. And then the guy who kind of gave him the... It was specifically an academic scholarship to a very sports-heavy school because the guy wanted it to be a better academic school.
Gotcha, okay.
So then that guy was like, hey, does your brother want one? Too, and my parents were like, yes, he does. Get that paste out of your mouth, Connor.
Are you the youngest, though?
I am the youngest, yeah.
Oh, younger, yeah. You're a younger kid.
And the best one.
The best one. Always the favorite.
Always, of course. How can you not be the baby? So I did that, and then I went to college, and I didn't... the first college I went to before I transferred, I didn't do any theater. I kind of missed it.
What was your major?
It was political science and economics.
Okay. What college did you go to?
I went to Gettysburg.
Oh, yeah,
which is how you're supposed to say it. That's what they say it there.
Gettysburg?
Gettysburg.
Oh.
It is a very rural, middle-of-nowhere Pennsylvania.
I was going to say,
Peak Pennsylvania.
Still famous for the battle.
Yeah, that's really... People are like, where is that? I'm like, the battle. That's where the battle was. Come on. But it's very rural.
They're like, oh, you mean Gettysburg? And you're like...
Gettysburg. But it's very rural. It's very, you know, rural Pennsylvania.
So you did a year there.
A year there, yeah. And then I transferred to Georgetown. And when I transferred to Georgetown, the first year there was a little bit rough. It wasn't my low point that we're talking about, but it was a low point. I didn't have a lot of friends.
Yeah. Did they fit you with like a transfer program to meet people?
They did,
all?
And it just kind of like I didn't gel with the guys I was with so much, and it was just kind of I wasn't really in any clubs or anything because there's all of your social life is kind of what you do extracurricularly. Yeah. So I kind of wasn't really doing that. I was doing like mock trial a little bit on the side, but it wasn't like a ton. So it was kind of a rough year. And then my second year at Georgetown, my junior year, I tried out for a bunch of plays.
What made you, I guess, make that jump back into acting?
I wanted to try it.
Had it always been something you wanted to do?
It was always something I'd want to try, but it seemed like such an impossible way to like live your life. So I was always hesitant to do it.
Yeah.
What was nice about Georgetown is that it was very student theater heavy. So it really wasn't necessarily being part of the program. There was the program, the theater program, which I wasn't part of. But there were like student extracurricular groups that put on very, you know, quality productions that I was able to kind of be a part of. So I kind of got more chances to be there because in most colleges, if you're not like a theater major, they won't really let you they won't really have you be in any of the
right. Because they have like the theater production of the school, but it looks like there were some outlet clubs.
Clubs and stuff. And like I also knew theater kids were also super, you know, warm and kind of they're easier to make friends. They're very they're pretty open.
Yeah, you have to be. I mean, it goes with everything, right? Because you have to be pretty open to be a part of that stuff.
So I figured it was a way to do it, and I got a small part in like the fall play. So that kind of was kind of the start of
it. What was the play?
It was Inherit the Wind.
Ooh.
about the Scopes Monkey Trial.
What was your I think we read this play.
I was the judge.
Oh, Judge Canning.
I got to be on stage a lot. I didn't have a lot of lines.
And you're like, I loved it.
Did not have a lot of lines. I was on stage a lot. But it was fun. Yeah, that was. And then I got, I just kind of kept auditioning and kind of doing that. And I got to know the program a little bit. I ended up minoring in theater. I was in more, pretty much, I was in, you know, kind of plays for the next couple of years. And I, actually, I was in this small kind of workshop class with this actually Irish director named Joe Dowling. Mm-hmm. He founded the Gaiety Theatre in Dublin, and I don't know if he founded, but he was a director at, what's it called, a big theater in Minneapolis that I can't think of right now, but a very famous, the Guthrie Theater. Mm-hmm. He was the artistic director there.
So you get the opportunity to work with a director who's clearly experienced.
He's very professional. Yeah, very professional. And he kind of suggests, and we kind of bonded over being Irish and that kind of thing.
Makes sense.
You know, was able to do that. Because I was going to visit Ireland.
Oh, that year. Okay.
At that soon. Yeah, yeah. Around there, so. And he kind of suggested I give it a try, so I kind of, you know.
In the sense for a career.
Yeah, so yeah. I knew I needed more training because I didn't really have any. So I auditioned for the year after that, I auditioned for like a ton of MFA programs.
And you're a senior at this point at Georgetown.
I graduated, and then I moved back to DC and kind of worked there and was auditioning for MFA programs the next cycle.
So you're living in DC a year after college. Where are you working?
Just at a restaurant. Theater. So one of the theater directors, her husband owned. He was a famous chef in DC, actually.
Okay. So you're working there, and then. For an MFA, that's a master's in fine arts.
Yeah, you have to audition.
And you have to audition and do. So were you doing, not to age you too, what you, this is pre-COVID.
This would have been 2016.
2016, okay. So
I was 2016 and late 2016, early 2017. I was taking the bus up to New York and auditioning for MFA programs.
Okay. Oh, so you were auditioning in New York.
Yeah, all the auditions are in New York. Yeah.
Gotcha, okay. What were those like?
They're awful, dude. They're crazy. Yeah. Like, because for some of them, you have to pay money. For your application to apply.
Yeah.
And then you pay money to audition for some of them, not all of them. And then you audition and you only get like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So it's like, that was it. I mean, the worst one, so the reason I'm in the program I am, I hadn't originally planned on applying to the program I went to, but I had an audition for, what was it? It was UC San Diego. No, yeah, UC San Diego. They had a really great, it was like tuition free. So I really wanted to get into this program. Yeah. And I just remember I paid like an audition fee at the door to audition on top of my application fee. And I just walked into the room. And I think it was a huge room, just one lady in there. You immediately open your mouth and you're like, I don't got it. It's not happening. You can just tell on the first, you do two monologues and you can tell on the first one. She doesn't care. I don't feel it. I don't got it. So then you come out and they tell you, we don't need you to come back or whatever. And you're just like, you're just so down because you spent so much time on this application.
Yeah.
And prepping for the monologues and you had 5 minutes and you could just tell from the second you didn't have it. So for the next one, I was like, I need to warm up. I need to warm up. I've always needed to warm up.
Before I go into
my next audition.
Sure.
And there was a program that had walk-in auditions. Most of them didn't have walk-in auditions. But it was a program that had walk-in audition, so I filled out the application, and I did a walk-in audition, and it was the best audition that I did. That walk-in audition ended up calling me back, which was one of the few callbacks that I got for those MFA auditions. And then a couple weeks later, they asked me for a couple more materials, and then...
After the callback?
After the callback. So I didn't hear from them, and then a couple weeks later, they asked me for some more materials, didn't hear from them, and then eventually they offered me a spot at Case Western Reserve University Cleveland Playhouse. Which was crazy lucky because it was one of the few programs at that time that was totally free and also paid you a stipend.
Wow. Yeah. So you didn't have to pay tuition and you got to go.
Yeah, and I couldn't take any more loans.
Right.
Yeah, so it wasn't going to work. So I got incredibly lucky to get into that program.
Gotcha. So you must have been like elated.
It was scary too because I actually had never visited the campus. I didn't know anything about, I'd never been to Cleveland before I went out there.
Yeah.
And it was it was the only one I could even really get into, which was really exciting. My entry point into that program was a little rough. I broke up with my college girlfriend. She broke up with me 2 days before I moved out there.
Oh,
yeah.
Geez.
On the phone.
Oh.
And last time I saw her, she was my girlfriend.
No.
It was rough. To be fair, we very much needed to break up, but the whole situation was not great.
Well, it's so much change, right? Because now it's your...
so much change.
Yeah.
It was so... And she was going to a different MFA program for directing.
Okay.
So it was a whole... It was, like I said, we very much needed to break up, but it was so much change. And then you're thrown into this world. Like I said, I didn't come from an acting background, so I wasn't as used to it. The first year was definitely tough.
Yeah. What was, I guess, your day-to-day like when you're at the program?
So you would usually wake up. You have to be there usually around like 8-ish, I think, 8:30. We'd have movement class to start.
Movement class?
It's kind of like you get your body warmed up, and then it's a lot of just like a lot of yoga and Pilates to kind of like get a sense of like
just to like get in your body.
Yeah, it's called like proprioception. So you like the awareness of your body in space. Like, have you ever met anybody who like wasn't aware of how they moved their body and always bumped into stuff?
Plenty.
Yes. No. So, but it's like kind of like that. It's to kind of like get you more comfortable in space. And then you kind of, there's different like movement ideas where you can like, that gives you basically different vocabulary for how to describe movements and stuff, where you can kind of learn like, did this person like glide, or does they like ring, like you're ringing out like a towel, or did they float, or, you know, different like kind of verbiage and stuff like that, and different kind of things, and different, and you kind of learn to just kind of perform and move your body. Mm-hmm. And then we would usually have acting class after that, where we'd be running scenes, working on scenes.
From certain plays?
Yeah, they would be given to us by our professors, and we'd be running those and practicing them and rehearsing them. You know, like, the first one would be, like, more modern plays. First semester, we actually didn't even have any lines. The first semester, we would do, like, a lot of improv, a lot of silent.
For the whole semester?
Not the whole semester, but for the first couple of weeks, we would do a lot of, like, silent improv or just improvising. Or they would give you, like, it's called a blank scene, where you get like really standard dialogue where it's like two people and it's like, what's that? What do you mean? Where? And you have to like kind of create a scene around that.
Okay.
So that was like the first semester. It was just kind of like getting thrown right into it.
Yeah. How were you feeling during this time? Where you feel like you were able to?
Oh, it was rough.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. Like I said, it was like a lot of transition. And then you're with the same seven people every single day over and over and over in this tiny white room, because it's a really small program. Most programs aren't eight people. Most are closer to like 12 to 16.
That's for the entire program?
The entire program.
That's crazy.
And so because of the way the program was set up, so they only have a class every other year. So there's not a lot of other students around.
Wow.
There's the first years and the third years, and then when you're a second year, it's just your class actually. So you're really in this one, you're with the same people 8 hours a day, over and over and over.
And did
over.
You guys live in like the same housing and stuff too?
Some people were roommates. I didn't live in the same housing though. Okay. I just lived in an apartment. Or no, actually had a house.
Okay.
Cleveland was very cheap before the pandemic. Oh my God. Rent was insanely low. It was so affordable. So yeah, you're just spending like, you're doing voice class, you're doing speech class, you're doing sometimes like workshops, rehearsing scenes, basically just doing theater stuff and performance classes every day. And it's tough. Like, you have to, like, be vulnerable at 8 o'clock in the morning sometimes.
Yeah.
And, like, you really don't want to. You have to, yeah, it's just like, you basically just, like, a crash course in figuring out how to be a performer.
Yeah.
But it was stressful. It was tough.
Were you happy to be there, though? Like,
yeah, I was definitely happy to be there. And I was definitely grateful that I got, like, a chance to just, like, study performance and study theater.
Sure.
But, like, I also kind of knew before this and after it, like, that I wasn't probably going to be a theater actor,
mm-hmm.
which is, like, a pretty specific career path. And it's gotten even more specific since COVID.
Right.
Like, I just don't love theater enough to make that my whole life.
Well, because when you were talking about theater, because I don't come from an acting background, but I know that theater acting is different from television acting.
Yeah, it's definitely different. I mean, it's usually easier to transition from theater acting to like on camera acting.
Yes.
The way they talk about it is like, so theater acting, like you're performing for the entire audience, right? So it has to be pretty big. People in the back row have to see you. If you're performing for like a on camera, the camera's right there. You don't need to be gigantic. It's much more subtle.
Yeah.
And it's easier to go from like big to small. But, like, the theater world is just very insular. It's, like, they're very... it's not... Culty is wrong. But there's, like, a culty element to the theater community.
No, I feel like...
And they kind of want everyone to kind of be the same kind of a person who feels things the same way and expresses their emotions the same way. And there are times in the program where... My classmates were always pretty okay with it, I think. I don't know. Maybe not. But even, like, my professors... I have kind of the sarcastic, kind of comic, darker outlook on things.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes theater people can be like that. Kind of brings,
I like how you said that. Like, I've seen your act.
You know what I mean? Like, or even just comics in general are so self...
Sure, sure.
Effacing and so self-deprecating that sometimes... And that's just like a natural thing that I have. Sometimes it could get exhausting for like... Because in theater, you have to be vulnerable and positive.
Right.
And just so positive about everything. So I kind of got the feeling in the program like I wasn't always going to be a theater actor. So that was giving me like a little bit of anxiety because I was like, I'm here for a theater program. It's probably not going to be my career path. It doesn't look like, I don't think I can make a living doing this.
Could you confide in like professors and stuff at this time around the program?
Yeah, I mean, I had professors I could talk to, and I mean, my classmates, you know, we had ups and downs in our relationship. Most, yeah. I mean, all most MFA classes are shit shows, for lack of a better word.
Really?
Everybody always bangs. Everybody always bangs.
Really? MFA
always
programs?
Bangs.
Wait, is it a lot in your group too?
There wasn't. My class was pretty good. Okay. All things considered, we were actually
very. Do you still talk to them? Or?
Yeah, yeah. We're
oh,
still,
nice.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
All things considered, we were very good.
Nice.
But there's always tons of drama.
Sure.
And it's hard because you're usually, you know, you're all young and attractive. Yeah. You're all making art. And you're all doing, it's called, like, it's really, people can be very attractive because they're doing something they're good at, right?
Sure.
It's very attractive to watch someone who's good at something do it. So it's, and then, but then you realize, like, so you're doing that every day, but it's not real life, man. It's,
yeah, that's, yeah.
It's, I mean, it's, I've heard of people called like a showman's where you have like a relationship with someone you're doing
sure,
a show.
Sure, I've heard that too. Yeah.
Yeah, so
that's
it's,
really funny.
Like, yeah, I mean, but like, I've heard just, other classes are just absolute nightmares.
Yeah.
Of just everybody banging people and banging people they're not supposed to bang and people being married and leaving their wives for people and people sleeping with different classmates they're not supposed to. And yeah.
Oh my God.
It's tough. It's a hard, because like you said, you're spending so much time together.
Right.
It's hard to have a social life, and you're all just like young and attractive artists.
Yeah, and it's
yeah.
Oh wow.
So it was. I mean, it was. Yeah, it was hard. It was rough. A lot, and you're just stuck together all the time. Cleveland winters are tough.
Yeah.
It's dark. So I was glad to be there, and I was really. I mean, it was like it's such a privilege to be able to just like I said, just do theater classes for like 3 years. But, it, you know, it is anxiety-inducing. You want to get certain parts in the productions or you want to do certain stuff, and it's a letdown when it doesn't happen. But for the most part, it was, you know, by the third year, I felt like the third year is mostly an apprenticeship, so you take a lot less classes and you're like an understudy at the Playhouse. So the third year, I was definitely, and you do your solo show, which I had a lot of fun doing.
Right.
You have to, like, kind of half write and perform. You can use, like, other texts, but you can have to, like, make your own solo show.
Mm-hmm.
But it was definitely a challenge, the spending, like, all that time, like, just with the same people and learning the skills and stuff. But by the third year, I felt like I had kind of a grasp on it more, and it was kind of coming through a little
sure.
bit. And then COVID hit.
During your third year?
During my third year. Wow. I was in a production of Antigone, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. I was like an ensemble character
okay.
in that. And that was, yeah, we were, that was going to be all, I think pretty much everybody in my class was in that, maybe except one person. So it was going to be like our final show. And then we had our like showcase scheduled for May 11th, 2020 in New York City, which obviously it did not happen. Yeah. So that was something we were working on that like the whole year to do scenes yeah. for like managers and stuff. Everything got shut down.
Was that, had you gotten the chance to perform in front of managers and stuff before?
No. That was like, it's, the showcase is definitely a big part of MFA, like
that's,
going to an MFA program.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it was tough. It was tough. It was frustrating.
Yeah.
And then you know, everything gets shut down. Antigone gets closed. The NBA gets canceled. The whole world shuts down. Yeah. And then you move back home.
Did you say the NBA?
Well, that was, I feel like that was the moment everyone realized it was real, right? Oh, when they were like, oh yeah. my God, they canceled yeah. NBA games? Oh, crap. This is a real thing.
I just love that was your example.
I think that was yeah. when I was like, oh, this is going to be like a whole thing. This is going to
like
be.
The classic straight man. Oh, no. LeBron.
They're shutting. Oh God. This is real.
No, I do remember that moment. That moment too, when they shut it down.
So yeah, then you move back home and you're like, I just spent 3 years learning how to do classical theater acting, and I already wasn't 100% sure I was gonna be a classical theater actor.
Yeah.
And now the whole industry has completely changed. I don't even know if it's gonna even open up again.
Can I ask? And I don't mean this in like a demeaning way or anything. I'm genuinely curious. What was your plan after graduating? And I ask in the sense, like, you were just kind of immediately thrown into after.
Yeah.
Like, thinking about the after.
The plan was going to be to move to New York
yeah.
and have an audition with my agent.
Right. Okay, so that makes sense.
That was always the plan. Instead, I just kind of moved back home.
Right. So you, in other words, you couldn't execute on that plan you wanted to because
obviously
nothing.
Could not,
yeah.
I couldn't.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no, the city had shut down. There was no auditions.
Yeah.
No one. There was no point in being in New York at that time.
Right.
Everybody in New York was trying to leave.
So you, yeah, oh my God. It's weird. My fiance tells me stories like she would walk through because she worked for like some company that basically made her come in.
Yeah.
And she
During the peak pandemic.
Yeah, during the pandemic, she had to go in and, you know, just she would see the streets of New York just completely empty.
Yeah, so no one wanted
to
be
so eerie.
Yeah, it was crazy. And so, like, you didn't even know if things were going to open up again. You were trying to figure out, like, we had, like, an online showcase where you posted some online monologues, but.
Yeah, but that's not the same.
That was not
yeah.
the same.
So you
no
moved home after this.
Moved home to my parents.
You were already unsure about doing
already theater. Unsure. And then, so there's theater where I grew up in the Berkshires, and I tried to kind of get involved in that, but everything was kind of still shut down. There was, like, even into 2021, they were doing, like, shows in tents. And it was mostly like because no one was working. It was really only established actors who were getting
because
no one was looking for new talent or anything. So I kind of just hunkered down with my parents. I was still sending out auditions and self tapes, and that was also just a huge. You know, I was so used to for 3 years. You're going in person, you're performing live, and you're getting feedback. And there's an audience, and there's a crowd, and you have a stage. You have somebody on stage with you. You have a partner to react with and play off of. And then all of a sudden, it's just everything is a self-tape.
Yeah, and you're
everything is you have to plant, you have to do all the whole setup. You're doing it, you're having a camera right here. You need a reader. Your reader is your mom, who is doing anything with your mom is just stressful, right? And there's nothing. The only thing that's worse than your mom giving you a note on acting,
she would give you notes.
Is your mom giving you a good note? That is the worst feeling in the world. I don't know what it is, but when she would and they're like. No, she's right. I hate that she's right so much. Like, I went to school for 3 years for this.
You're like, you don't even have an MFA.
You've never even acted. You don't even like public speaking. And you're giving me a good note. And
that's
so it's just
funny.
That, that's that getting mad at your mom for no reason.
No, I know.
And you're just trying to figure out lights and everything. And it's just, it doesn't feel like you're acting
at
all.
It just feels like you're sending these out into the abyss. Into
and no one
nothing.
Sees them. You could even see sometimes. I mean, I would stop doing this to drive myself crazy. But you could be like, I'd be like, there's no views on it. I know you didn't watch it.
Yeah.
There's no downloads either. Like, I know you didn't. So that was a bummer. And that definitely took a toll. Because I was still sending things out. And still auditioning and applying to things from home, but it was just like it just the bleakness of only being on camera, of only being using your iPhone and being in your room and using your box lights was just it didn't feel like I was acting. It didn't feel like art.
And can I tell you too, like just in my journey right now, just being unemployed and doing all these interviews and doing it's a little different obviously with like I'm interacting with people.
Yeah.
But I get it. It's like because you're not physically feels like you're just kind of. And it takes energy to put yourself out there like that.
And
that's the thing.
It's energy, and it's not what you... Yeah, interviewing is very different from work or anything else, you know what I mean? Or auditioning is very different from actually being in something.
Yeah.
And it was just... It was a bummer.
How many self-tapes do you think you sent out?
Oh, hundreds, probably.
Wow.
Because I was there until 2022. So I stayed with my parents for about 2 years.
And you didn't hear back from, like, anything?
I mean, you heard back from some stuff. Or, like, you know, small little, like, a stage reading here or there.
Sure.
But it was so limited.
Given, like, the circumstance.
Especially since
everything.
I wasn't in New York. And then, you know, that I was working in a dispensary at the time.
I love that for you.
I got to read a lot.
I was going to say, yeah, there you go. And I would love walking into a dispensary and seeing you.
I was actually at the door. I was checking IDs.
That's great.
So I got to read. So if no one was good, I could just read and just check IDs. It was amazing, dude. It was actually awesome.
You're like, this is the best job.
I read a shitload. I read
bet.
So much.
Yeah. That's awesome.
It was brutal. And then I moved to New York in 2022 and I had an agent.
Wait. So take us back. So, okay. So you're working this job and then, because I really just want to get into the feeling of, you know, your home. And I don't mean to dwell on the negative feelings, but like there must just be the sense of like hopelessness.
Yeah, I was like, I don't know what the, I mean, I don't even know what the, if the world's going to open back up again before the vaccine, before what the industry's going to look like. I mean, so many theaters shut down, especially so much. It was limited. It's squeezed so much work out of the industry, not even just the theater, especially because it was live performance, but film and TV, too. You were like, I don't know if what's it going to look like when things do open back up? Are they going to open back up? Like, is there any space for newer people in this?
Did you ever have, because I went through a similar thing with comedy where I did quit for a while.
Yeah.
Did you have a thought that, you know, maybe about quitting?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Like, I don't know how to do, like, how am I going to keep doing this? Like, is it just going to be me in my parents' basement doing self-tapes? Is that what acting is?
Right.
Like, I don't want to do that, really. That didn't seem to be like what I wanted to do.
But you held on to something, I guess, then, right?
Yeah, I wanted to get to New York.
Yes, that was the main.
That was like this is all like the pandemic, and I was like, I need to just get to New York once things open back up.
Sure.
Because one of the reasons I delayed is I didn't want to just be stuck in my apartment if things were still closed off. Like,
yeah,
you know
that
what
makes
mean?
Sense.
Like,
yeah, because why are you gonna? What's the point of moving to New York if everything's still closed? Right?
You know, so it was like, and even so, I definitely was able to take some time to kind of figure stuff out.
Yeah.
So that was helpful from the pandemic, and my parents gave me plenty of time, and we're. very supportive, so that was great. But yeah, it was definitely like hopelessness, definitely thinking about quitting, and just trying to find a way to get back on stage and get back performing.
So it's now we're getting to like 2022, stuff's like finally starting to. When did you make the decision to move to New York that you were like,
probably January. I was like, I need to be there by June.
Gotcha. Okay. In 2022. So you're starting to see stuff open up.
Starting to look at apartments, starting to take the train down to look at neighborhoods. Because I never been. I knew the city. I'd been to the city, but I didn't know neighborhoods. I didn't know how to get around, really. I didn't know.
So you took the train down by yourself just to look around?
Yeah. Not to look around, but I would go to apartments and stuff and check out things from Craigslist listings and stuff just to get a feel for the city.
And where'd you move to first?
Where I am now, West Harlem.
Oh, nice. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So you were in the same spot.
Yeah, same spot. It was supposed to be a sublet, and then it kind of just. Ended up staying.
Yeah. So you moved in like June 2022.
June 2022. Got an agent, which was good. Started auditioning.
How did you, just because some people listening might have questions about it, how did you get an agent?
I use just cold submissions.
Really?
So you can use things called like Agent Blasters, which gives you like a whole list of basically every agent with their emails and just sending out a bunch of emails with your headshot and resume and what you're looking to do. Most of them don't get back to you. A handful got back, and one person ended up working with me.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah,
which was great. I mean,
and the idea is that this person gets you work.
Yeah, so the idea is they'll submit me for like more real stuff. So I was auditioning for like real TV shows and not like short films, not like student stuff.
So you would submit like with a self-tape, headshots.
Yeah, so they would send me like an audition for like Law and Order or you know, what are the other ones? I auditioned for Daredevil when they were originally casting that. The Penguin.
Oh, that's cool.
That was cool.
Is that annoying when non-actor people hear a show that like they know and they're like, oh, that's cool.
No, I'm the same way.
I'm very self-conscious.
No, I'm the exact same
way.
I was like, no, that is what the cooler. Yeah, that is way cooler. But the bummer about that is I got my agent in August 2022.
Which is pretty good. You moved in June, got an agent in August.
That's what the MFA was kind of for. So the MFA helped me. I got the agent because they do
so that's interesting. So again, as someone as an outsider, the MFA tells the
they had worked with someone else from my program.
Oh, gosh, so connected. Okay, network.
So it's absolutely, it was the reason I got an agent. And then I tore my ACL.
Oh, my God, how'd you do that? Wait, I didn't even know this part.
Yeah. So
my God. Spoilers, I knew some of the story.
December 2022 or January 2023, I tore my ACL playing soccer.
Oh, just like free doing?
So I had heard it, and then I kept playing on it. And I heard it again, kept playing on it again, and then
it just tore.
And then it just it's actually like detached. Technically, my ACL didn't actually tear; it like detached from the wall.
Wait, did we meet shortly? I think after this healed.
Yeah, no, we met before I even had surgery.
That's when it was.
The reason I started doing stand-up.
Is that what? Because your ACL?
I was like, I need to do stuff. I need to get out of the house. I can either do stand-up or play soccer. And I was like, I'm going to play soccer because I like soccer.
Yeah.
And stand-up's scary and I don't want to do it. Then I tore my ACL and I was like, well, I guess the only way for me to get out of the house.
That's not a push.
It really was. It was like, I can do this. I can still do it even though my knee was like really just swollen or whatever. It was fine.
So now you lost your agent because of your ACL? Because like you couldn't work?
I still had my agent. I lost my agent like a year later when they shut down.
The agency shut down.
Yeah, after my surgery, which I got October 2023, I was still auditioning a bit with my agent, and then like the next that March they shut down.
Wow.
Yeah, but initially, it was the reason I got into stand-up, and stand-up was like kind of a revelation because you're back on stage, you can do it, and you can do it wherever you want. I don't need to have my camera; I can just go to an open mic.
Well, that's the beautiful thing about stand-up, and I think what. Because you're acting, directing, producing,
and you can just go
writing.
Do it.
Yeah,
I got $5. I can just go walk into Black Cat and they have
and just
to listen
perform.
To me.
Yeah, and it's funny because I talked to some other actors that like got into stand up as well, and it's like, this is the thing with acting and why. And again, I come from the school where it's like I always wanted to be a stand up. I've never considered acting or anything like that. But what the biggest disadvantage is with actors is. I feel like the decision it needs to be made by someone else with stand up.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like
you need someone
cast
to cast
something.
You,
you need someone to cast you with stand up. You just need to win the audience.
Exactly. You just need
and
to go out there.
You
just
need
to,
go out
thing.
There and do it.
Yeah.
Which is so, and that's why like I feel bad for actors. Cause in my mind, like acting is so much harder just in the sense of where do you perform? Yeah, that's how do you rehearse?
That was what was killing me. Like, yeah, just, the only connection that I really had with acting. I mean, you could take classes, but in New York they're very expensive,
super expensive.
And
yeah,
the only connection I had was just doing self tapes in my apartment. And
so you came. Sorry, go ahead.
No.
I was just gonna say. So you tore your ACL. You're like, I need to do something to get on stage. Yeah. What made you think of stand up specifically?
So the solo show that I had written in my program was about a stand up. Who was?
What was it?
The reason I wrote it the way I did is I didn't want to do like the fourth wall break where you're just talking to the audience. Mm. I never liked that about solo shows. I always thought drama is two people talking.
Yeah.
So mine was it was about a stand up, basically a stand in for an actor, because I didn't want to write about an actor.
Sure.
It was about a stand up having a.
Which, by the way, that's the same reason It's Always Sunny is about setting a bar, because I didn't want to do actors.
Exactly. Yeah. But I didn't want, so I it's about a stand-up having a crisis of confidence before he goes on stage and he hears voices and he has conversations with the offstage voices.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I'd always like stand-up, always been interested. I was a huge Louis fan.
Okay.
I loved his show. I was a big Louis C.K. fan. The Me Too stuff kind of made me take a bit of a hiatus from a lot of his work, sure. I'll be honest. Mostly because I was literally defending him. To a female friend.
Oh, no.
Like, the day before it broke.
Oh,
so
really?
Literally the day before. I kind of took it a little personally. Because I was like, he didn't do that. And then he was like, no, I did absolutely all of that. I was like, okay. Well, that kind of made me look like an idiot. She was very nice about it.
She let
me off the hook. She was very nice. But I remember being like, okay, this is... What you did wasn't great, but you also did something to me, you know? Yeah. You also made me look stupid, Louis, which that's unacceptable.
That's funny.
But I always liked stand-up. My mom was always a big George Carlin fan.
Sure, yeah.
You know, my mom actually liked a lot. You know who my mom really liked, apparently?
I think we need to get your mom in the art. She's giving you good notes. She has great taste.
I remember my mom being like, you know what one of my favorite stand-up specials was? It was like, she was like, Eddie Murphy when he wears that suit. And you like Raw by Eddie Murphy? That's one of your favorite stand-up specials, Mom?
You're like, Mom.
What? Are you cool, Mom? What is going on? That's bizarre.
Connor, we're learning your mom is sick.
Raw? Like the raunchiest stand-up of all time?
So funny.
Damn. Anyway, so I'd always kind of wanted to do stand-up.
Sure. So it was always like in the back.
And then there's all, I mean, you're in New York. You see a lot of things for shows. There's always kind of like, you know, people talking about stand-up shows. There's always bars.
Sure.
There's always comedy clubs around. And so then I went to like a West Side comedy club because it's the closest one to me. It was like one of those 8 o'clock shows or whatever.
Just to check out a show.
Just to check out a show. Just to see comics who are, you know, booked on those shows. And I was like, oh, okay, so I could do that, definitely.
Do you remember I don't want to say that. Well, not in a negative sense, but I'm remembering. Do you remember seeing any comics that really spoke to you at that show?
That show, no. So there was one Eastern European comedian I loved. I thought he was hilarious.
Yeah.
He crushed. Nice. I think he was in Belarus.
Okay.
A lot of his stuff was Belarus heavy.
Sure.
I thought it was hilarious.
big Belarus.
Big, lot of Belarus comic stuff. I actually went to I got tickets to an even smaller show. Remember Stand Up NY back at the when it was.
Sure, yeah.
So they used to do like satellite shows at some hotel nearby.
Did I just talk about this with Amy? It was like a small room, right?
It was a tiny little
room. Oh my God, this literally came
it
up
like
on the last
Monday.
Episode.
It was like on a Monday.
Yeah.
And it was somebody, somebody just gave me the tickets randomly.
Okay, so you went to
And
go.
It was, what's funny is that Eric Walsh was on that show, who I see
He's
at open
great.
Mics all the time,
yeah.
Who's hilarious.
Yeah.
And
go
also,
follow him too.
And also, who has recently since blown up since then is Jeff Arcuri was on that show too.
Really?
Which is kind of crazy because
cool.
He's pretty huge right now.
Yeah.
So those guys, I mean, that show, I mean, it was the show itself was terrible. It was like in a tiny lounge. It was not.
Sure, just the quality.
But the comics were a little stronger.
Sure,
it felt stronger.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, and then, I mean, I don't know how you were when you were planning on your first set, but I wrote out like my first set, like completely word for word and was going over it, like so nervous about it. And then finally just like went to an open mic at.
How soon after you saw that show?
Pretty soon, a couple
weeks. That's good.
Yeah. And then, you know, you go to your first open mic and it's in a dank basement
and
it's a bunch of weirdos.
You're so nervous.
And you're so nervous.
You're so nervous.
And you're I mean, it's just craziness. And then, but then you're kind of like, oh, I like this, though. Like, there's a point where you're like, oh, I enjoy this is.
Did you get laughs?
I think I got a couple laughs. Nice. I went way too fast, obviously.
Way
too fast.
Yeah.
But there was something about the energy of it that was like, this is weird, but I like. I knew it was not a good energy necessarily, or you've been to open mics, it can be tough, but like I just liked it. It felt like home a little bit.
Did you? Oh, that's really
it
sweet.
Felt like home more than theater ever did.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, it definitely. Yeah. It was like I kind of was like, I knew I liked performance. I knew I wasn't, but theater acting was really my only frame of reference, and I knew that wasn't going to be it. Film and TV felt I didn't know enough about it, and it was so hard, and it was complicated, and it was difficult to do your own film and TV. So I was like, where do I fit in performance? How do I do this?
Yeah,
and I was like, oh, stand up. That so makes sense.
It kind of clicked for you then.
It helped make a lot. It helped things make a lot more sense.
It
kind of retconned like theater school being like a good decision a little bit.
Did you? Yeah, because I was just going to ask, like, I guess in hindsight, it must have made sense that you were like, oh, this is kind of
it
where.
It was more like this is the avenue that this is the performance space that's like more me.
And what's great is like, I feel like coming from an actor background, the advantage is. And this is going to sound so silly, but like what really illuminates or illuminated for me, like a lot of things about stand-up is that it's called an act for a reason. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, so it's you have to it's more than the words. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like
you can say the words so many different ways and get a laugh or not.
Oh,
get
exactly.
A laugh.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, that's, yeah.
But it was
so
just something about like, I just got along so much better also with comics than I ever did with actors. I don't have a problem with actors at all. Not at all. I love actors. They're great.
Sure. But and not all actors, I will say this so you don't have to, there's definitely a different, stigma associated with actors than comics. Yeah. I think that's fair to say.
And one of the things, like I said, I kind of mentioned before, is like,
not that I hate owl.
Actors kind of have to, sometimes it will feel like actors have to convince themselves that what they're doing is important and that it's a good idea for them to spend their time and effort acting. Mm-hmm. Whereas a comic will tell you that they're wasting their time. They know this is dumb. They know what they're doing is pointless.
That was, yeah.
You know, there is absolutely no value to anything that they say.
Sure.
No, very few comics will be like, no, this is actually like really. I'm a serious truth teller. It's like, shut up. No, you're not. You tell dick jokes at Black Cat Cafe. But that's what I like about it, is that everyone's kind of like, yeah, this is dumb, but I like doing it. It's my favorite
thing.
Yeah,
well, that's the...
It feels a little more clear-eyed about it.
Yeah,
know?
There's definitely... Well, because what was so funny is I thought when you were saying that you were going to go the opposite way, and I was ready to be like, I don't think it's important, and then you're like,
exactly. And a comic will be like, yeah, this is... Why am I even here? You'll hear the comics saying that all the time. Why do I do this? Even comics who make it, they're like, this is so weird.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They're so self-deprecating about it that it just felt so much... I felt more comfortable.
Totally. And again, it's just... I don't know. It's... Because I was really thinking about this, right? Like, why is stand-up kind of having a boom? And I don't know if it's... It's not... Probably... Look, here's the thing with, like, stand-up. Like, it's... I was talking about this with Amy on the last episode, and, like, it's not as... big as it was pre-COVID.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, like a lot of clubs shut down after COVID, like it's still very prominent right now. And
oh, it's huge. The social media clips are huge. Yeah.
Right. And it's like, but why? Like, why is stand-up so popular now? And I think what's really beautiful about it is that it is at its best, and I want to clarify that, it is a one of the most truest forms of self-expression we have right now.
Probably, yeah.
And we're living in a time where, like, again, you zoom out, right? Like, this is it's the height of it's ever been, you know? So it's, I don't know, I kind of, and, you know, just whatever kind of way we can be a part of it, I think is cool. I just think it's cool. Again, I don't think it's important.
Yeah.
Again,
but there's right? something like, about, like just, it's
well,
it's
I don't
want to
say not important, but, you know, you get what I'm saying. Like, people, I come from a family of doctors and nurses. Like,
it's
I'm not
the
compare.
Most important thing in the world.
Right, it's not life or death, you know?
But it like, is, yeah, it's, yeah, it just feels like it's somewhere I'm comfortable. The people I like the scene. I like the
you do look very comfortable on stage.
Or just the people it attracts too. It seems one of the things, like I said, I think I mentioned with acting, especially theater acting, they kind of want to they want people who are all like kind of the same. Not necessarily people who look the same or have the same background.
Yeah.
But people who feel things the same way.
Sure.
And people who express emotions the same way. And one of the things I like about stand-up is there are people who are so insanely different from me and who perform so tremendously different from me who are still so funny. There's more variety, it feels like. You know what I mean?
Can,
and there's so many, you can meet every kind of person who's a comic. Every kind of act. There's people who are musical acts. There's people who are completely monotone. There's people who only talk about sex, people who never talk about sex. You know what I mean? There's just such a breadth of the people you could meet that it's refreshing.
And it's also, too, it's also like, I think it's a Jerry Seinfeld thing where it's like when he immediately meets another comedian, he immediately feels comfortable because there is that shared experience.
It's
that like,
yeah, there's a brotherhood there.
Yes, there is, because it's, I mean, to do this is crazy.
Even if you're like a nobody, you know what I mean? Like, there's still just like a, you still go on stage, you still do this thing. Yeah. Like,
you said my favorite thing, and I don't even know if you remember this, but I think about this all the time, which is that I forget we were talking with someone, and it was a newer comic who was talking about how they, and I don't remember their name, but I won't say even if I did, but I remember they were like, yeah, I don't know, trying to be a comedian, like, you know, that kind of thing. And you go, no, if you're on there telling jokes, like, you're a comedian.
That's what I mean.
I was like, that's really true.
Yeah. I kind of instantly, even like when you meet someone, like it's their first or second time, like there's, you can kind of tell when they're like, oh, you kind of fit in. You know what I mean? Like, oh,
yeah.
I get why you're doing this.
Yeah,
you're bad
totally.
At it. Don't get me wrong. Like, but I can see how you will be kind of good at this eventually. Like,
no,
I don't know if it's a certain personality type. I think somebody else, I don't know if I refer to it, but somebody else referred to like the stand-up scene as kind of like the island of misfit toys too, where it's
it makes sense because like if you're doing this too, it's like, you know, you're
investing time and effort into
and so much time and effort. And the other thing is too, it's like I was listening to an older comic say that, you know, you just got to be really bad at it for a long time.
Really, really do.
And
it's
if
the
you
hardest
can do
thing,
that,
it's one of the hardest things to be good at.
So. Yeah, it's so hard. But
like even like it takes literally years to even get decent at.
It takes
like,
10 years to get good, man.
So
it's
crazy.
But no, I think it's wonderful that like you found this home through. I think it's so funny you tore your Achilles, and that's what led you to
stand. I know, right? Like that was. I mean,
talk about not being able to stand up.
Ayo,
rim shot. No, that was awful.
No, but seriously, stand-up definitely did, like, I mean, you know, I was very glad and grateful to be in theater school and have that opportunity, but there was a part of me that was like, I'm not going to be, like, a theater guy. I don't sing and dance either, so I'm not going to be in musicals.
Sure.
The film and TV world is crazy hard to break into and is almost impossible now after COVID, like to just break in without following. I mean, it's not impossible, but it's...
Well, the whole industry has changed. And
it's so
like,
much harder than it ever was.
And we talked about this off mic and with Amy on the last episode, but, you know, it's just people want that fully formed thing now. It's just, there's not a lot of benefit in taking on, you know, new talent and developing it. But at the same time, what is really, I think, the result of that is there is a whole indie scene that has developed, and there's this whole network of bar shows
and you have
stores
more
at bookstores, shows
stuff,
at bookstores in Hoboken, and look at that, and you know, just all this different cool stuff that's happening. But you know, I mean, we talked a little bit about it too, but it's like it's a lot in your hands and stuff. But what I wanted to get back to, do you think you'll ever kind of get back to acting?
Oh yeah, I mean, I think it's I think the two can kind of work hand in hand.
Ideally. Oh, absolutely,
that would be
yeah.
the ideal. Would be like
to do.
And you kind of need a internet following to have any kind of traction in the industry
That's
in general.
Why I come back to why you need to do the history videos.
I know, which is
because here's the thing, and he's gonna get mad at me for doing this. I'm calling out you and Trevor Liberty specifically, who's another wonderful comic. Go follow him; he's hysterical. But
has he done the pod?
He hasn't done the pod yet. I had to cancel, unfortunately. But for you two specifically, what I love is that like you have a thing you can do online. For him, he's hysterical. Go look at his videos. Some of them he has up already. He barks for a grizzly pear.
Yeah, I've seen that.
And he does, and it's great. And it's like just do that. Put it online and be yourself, and it's perfect because you can get a lot of content out of it and do whatever. For you specifically, and I call out Trevor out of love, obviously. He's hysterical and
he's
I think
funny.
He's great, very talented. But for you, like obviously, it's with these history videos you've been doing, and what I've been trying to get Connor to do is to record these rants about history. They're so interesting that we talked about literally at the beginning of the podcast.
Yeah, we did talk
unprompted, about it. Might I add you, just from me asking you questions. And you put your voice and your spin on it, and we get to know you in such a unique way, which I think is great.
Yeah, that's, I mean, like, before stand-up, and I never would have thought to do that.
Well, that's the thing, and it's just...
When you meet people who can also, like, show you, you know, how to do that. You kind of learn, you know, that's what the other thing, you can meet people who, you know, they have podcasts, they make content, you can meet other kinds of creators. Like, it feels like... is like a lot of different creative people kind of get sucked to stand up. You know what I mean? So you can meet people who
totally,
you know what I mean? It's
yes.
a great way to meet people who are writers, who are actors, who are directors.
Absolutely.
Who
and there
are
people who leave stand up and go on to do other things because stand up teaches you, again, how to write, how to act, produce, direct. Because you are doing all of that for yourself on stage if you're really developing an act.
Exactly.
And, you know, going back to, I mean, this is an episode Ari Findling did, which is, he said one of my favorite things ever, and I come back to this all the time, which is like, don't think about who you want to be. Think about what you want to do.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, if it's, you know, you want to act or write scripts or do whatever, like, focus on that stuff. And, yeah. you know, I think, look, I try not to be so cynical with the word content, because I do kind of cringe when I hear it.
I know.
And not to, I know you and I feel the same way, but it's like, you know, maybe it's not content, but it's just maybe having the opportunity to put yourself out there in a way to an audience that you never would have had access to in the past, you know, is a good way to think about it.
No,
and to echo Amy from last episode, I know I'm quoting her a lot. Start an email list. That's just a
no,
rule of
thumb. No, apparently
that's
the best way.
That's what
people,
she said.
The email list
and
is
I will,
the best
anything Amy says I will do, which
get,
is just
yeah.
get to an email list for whatever you do, if it's scripts, anything. But yeah, man, I mean, we typically end with, you know, what advice would you give to someone going through something similar? So, you know, I mean, you kind of had this journey where you were, you were lost in circumstances that were out of your own hands. So
but it was, yeah, it was also contributing to other kind of general artistic, you know, be untethered artistically a little
yes,
bit.
Yes, yeah. So, I mean, like, if you're, I mean, if thinking back to where you were, like, if you could talk to yourself when you were living at your parents' house, working at the dispensary, like, I mean, specifically, right? It's like, wait till the pandemic's over.
Yeah,
but, like, something, you know, if someone who's in that maybe feels stuck.
I would say, like, is, if you do like performance and you're, I was sure that was kind of the artistic world, the creative world was one I wanted to be in. There's a pathway in there, I guess, is to kind of believe that, is that you can find a way in. And that, honestly, my recommendation would be to do stand-up. Maybe not if you want to be, not necessarily to be a stand-up, but to meet people, to find out different mediums of performance, to figure out if it's improv, to figure out if it's writing. Maybe it's the writing process. Maybe it's hosting a podcast. Like,
do something.
Something. Like, yeah. And stand-up is a way for you to kind of stay in that world, meet those people, network in that way, to kind of consistently perform every day if you want. In New York, you can absolutely perform every day if you want. Just to kind of stay persistent and stay in the game as long as you can until you can kind of figure out what you want to do.
And I love, and I'm kind of making it a little bit broader just, you know, in case there are creatives that might listen that maybe don't want to do stand up. Because I do like this idea of, like, it is great advice to do stand up. So that's not what I'm saying.
Yeah, no,
but
I know.
It's like, it's, you know, do something, because to piggyback off what you said, there's a real beauty in unintended consequences.
Yeah.
I come back to the show I run at the bookstore all the time, mm-hmm. which is that I didn't intend to do the show to meet one of my favorite, you know, someone I consider a mentor to me, in Gabe Malika.
Yeah, exactly.
But I met him because I did the show.
Of course.
So it's like, you know, just by doing stuff,
it
will lead to other things, which will lead to other things, which may not be the things that you want or are planning on.
But it can kind of keep
But they can fulfill you.
Yeah, keep you going forward.
Yeah,
and you can
exactly.
find what does fulfill you. Like,
so it's,
So yeah, I'm not going to be a theater actor, but you can kind of stay in it.
Or maybe you, I mean,
or maybe come back to it more.
Yeah, maybe come back to it at some point.
But,
and I'm sure there have been things that you take from that you put into stand-up.
Absolutely,
sure.
Of course. Yeah, every day. Every time I perform with it. So stay persistent, stay in the game as long as you can. If it's really what you want to do, you can find another avenue, or the avenue that's kind of right for you eventually.
I love that so much, Connor.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Connor, tell the people where they can find you.
You can follow me on Instagram or TikTok. It's at Connor Canning Live. It's CONOR is Connor, though.
Not two N's.
Not two N's. One N in Connor. CONOR CANNING LIVE.
I got a Connor with two N's.
Connor with one N is the right way.
Oof.
It's how they spell it in Ireland.
Let me tell you something.
The first name.
I got another friend, Connor, with one N. He said the same thing.
And it's how they spell it.
It's going to be.
If they spell it that way
tough.
In Ireland, then it's the right way. Two N's is mildly acceptable. Two N's and an E at the end, totally unacceptable.
Wait, I'm sorry.
C-O-N-N-E-R. I've seen C-O-N-N-E-R,
no.
Which is just
That's
an abomination. I don't even know if they should be, like, allowed to vote, honestly, if your name is spelled that way. That's wrong.
Connor, I love you so much, man. You're the best.
I love you too, buddy. Thank you so much for having this podcast.
Dude,
super fun.
Dude, this was great. Thank you so much for doing the podcast.
It was a blast, dude. Sorry I talked your ear off about philosophy and history for too long.
Never be sorry, dude. This was awesome. It was a great episode. And here's to hoping we left you a little higher.
Yeah.
We did it.
Hell yeah, dude. Yeah.